Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. In today's program, we reflect that many of the world's problems could be solved if we would only treat with reverence all that God created. During the bicentenary year of Britain's abolition of the slave trade, we ask who the people were who found themselves captured and forced into slavery. And from involuntary service, we move to voluntary service, as, 1500 years ago, Saint Benedict bound himself totally to spend his days in prayer and listening to the Word of God. Today he is known as the father of Western monasticism. We now hear more about the Benedictine way of life. Surely one person who should know something about St. Benedict and understand his message is the abbot of a 1300-year-old monastery. Abbot Edmund Power is the abbot of St. Paul's Outside the Walls in Rome, a Benedictine monastery founded in the early 700s on the burial site of St. Paul himself. Today, the work of the Apostle of the Gentiles continues as the monks serve the many thousands of pilgrims who visit the Basilica each year. Abbot Edmund speaks of the Benedictine presence at St. Paul's.
We normally reckon that the first Benedictine community was clearly established there by the year 720 AD under Pope Gregory II, who was a monk and had obviously taken his name from Gregory I, the first monk to become pope. So, yeah, we've been there a very long time. Benedict himself died 540, normally reckoned. So, yeah, it's under 200 years after his death.
He continued to talk about St. Benedict.
Well, we don't know an awful lot about him, except that there are two main documents that transmit his spirit. One is his rule, obviously, which he wrote himself and has had a huge influence on Western, well, not only spirituality, but culture. The other is the life of Benedict, written by Pope Gregory the Great, who, interestingly, was born probably in the year that Benedict died, 540, who in his Dialogues, Book 2, wrote the life of Benedict. It's embellished a little bit and it's got scriptural elements brought in. It's a hagiography, in other words, a theological work based on the saint's life, but probably its historical basis is reasonably sound. So on those two documents we can derive a picture of the sort of person Benedict was. He was born in Norcia, that's the modern name of the Italian town in Umbria, in the mountains there. It was called Nursia in the Roman period. It's a Roman city. It's still surrounded by the Roman wall. He was born there, so he'd be the child of a late Roman family, obviously formed in the Roman culture, although the Roman Christianized culture. From there, he went to Rome, where he studied for a while, then to Subiaco, which is now known as one of the places closely associated with him, and finally to Monte Cassino, where he died about the year 540.
Benedict had a twin sister, Scholastica, who also became a saint. She seems to have been quite a character.
According to the tradition, she was his twin sister. We know nothing about her, really, except what Gregory the Great says in the life of Benedict, and he says very little. But what he does say shows her in a very good light and Benedict in a slightly less good light. The story's probably fairly well known. She obviously followed Benedict with an interest in the monastic way, and apparently when he established his monastery, she established close by a monastery of nuns, sisters, and they would meet periodically. He was rather strict, it seems, but one day he'd gone down with a couple of his monks to talk to his sister, and they talked during the day about the spiritual life. She was very happy. Evening came. He said, "I've got to go now." she said, "Oh, no, please stay, please stay. Let's continue talking. It's so wonderful talking about these things." He said, "Sister, what are you asking? How can I go against my own rule?" No, more or less. So she just closes her eyes, purses her lips. Well, Gregory doesn't say that, but I can imagine it, and prays. And then an enormous storm breaks out. The rain pours down. Benedict looks out and says, "What have you done, sister? May God forgive you," and has to stay all night talking about the spiritual life. And she says, "Well, you didn't ask me, you wouldn't listen to me when I asked you, but God has listened to me." And so that's all we know about her. But the next thing, she dies very shortly afterwards. I don't know if there was a direct connection, but she dies, and then her soul is seen ascending to heaven in the form of a dove.
The names of Benedict and Scholastica have always been associated throughout the history of Western monasticism.
But she's in a way a symbolic figure, you know, a figure closely associated with Benedict in the beginnings of Benedictine monasticism, but also she's seen as the kind of patron saint or the founding mother of Benedictine sisters and nuns. And so the tradition, they go together, and which is nice, really, because it proves that the Benedictine rule is not male-orientated or female-orientated. It presents a monastic spirituality accessible to all, in fact.
Benedict and Scholastica were even buried together.
Benedict, it seems, had prepared a tomb for himself, and his sister died first. And according to the tradition, they're both buried at Monte Cassino in the Basilica. There is a tradition that the body of Benedict was taken to France to the monastery of Saint-Benoît-sur-Loire, but there's been conflict for a long while between French and Italian monks over exactly where Saint Benedict is. Personally, I think I'd, well, out of loyalty, I live in Rome now, I tend to favour the Italian version.
Although Benedict is known as the father of Western monasticism, he was not the first monk. However, he did bring a whole new impetus to monasticism in the West. Abbot Edmund explains.
Yeah, the monastic movement, if you can call it that, began way back. I mean, the earliest roots, you could say, are in the apostolic community described in the Acts of the Apostles, where the believers held all things in common and prayed together and so on. But then by maybe the 4th century, just when the empire was beginning to tolerate Christianity, at the time of the Emperor Constantine, the beginning of the 4th century, when the martyr spirit was no longer possible in a way, I mean, Christians had shown their love of Christ by shedding their blood. When the first emperor became Christian or favoured Christianity, and that was no longer a realistic possibility, the monastic movement seemed to have come to life at that time. Some say that it was an alternative form of martyrdom. In other words, taking yourselves away from the social context of life, the city life, the ordered life, into the desert to seek God was the new spiritual heroism. And that movement became very popular, especially in the East, in Egypt, in Palestine, in places that were dry and it was possible to live out of doors. But it also spread to the West, and the first monk of the West is often considered to be Saint Martin of Tours, who also became a bishop in France later. And they were all before Benedict.
Abbot Edmund describes Benedict's special gift to the monastic way of life.
So Benedict, in fact, is born into a world in which there is monasticism, different forms of monasticism, different rules, let's say, different ways of doing things. His genius was to bring together a number of currents in a particular rule that is livable, practical, and moderate. Because there are other monastic rules earlier than Benedict, some of which he uses, some of which have influenced him, but very often they're not livable, they're too extreme or excessive in certain ways, and it was he who pulled together the most livable currents and then presented his rule, which because of its effectiveness became the predominant rule in Western Europe.
Benedict put monasticism within the grasp of those who wanted to live a monastic life, but who were not called to an asceticism that was sometimes extreme.
Benedict doesn't have, for example, a very excessive sense of asceticism. Asceticism means, the difficulties you voluntarily take on as part of your spiritual combat. You know, the image of warfare, spiritual warfare, is a strong image in the spiritual tradition. You hear, for example, of monks in the Celtic parts of the British Isles, you know, way back, who would spend all night long in the sea up to their necks in the winter, you know, great athletes of the spiritual life. But, I mean, none of us do that nowadays. It's difficult to see how that would lead you closer to God, but maybe it would.
Benedict showed that to be close to God, it wasn't necessary to be a hermit. People can find God through living in community and as a result of working together in service of the God who calls us.
The basic living together in community is an ascetical experience. You know, the overcoming of your selfishness in the service of others, the being regular at the prayer, regular at the service, getting up very early for the meditation on the Word of God. These are all elements of a more moderate sort of asceticism, a more livable asceticism. And I think that's something that people found they could respond to.
Reverence for all that God had created was the hallmark of the life of St. Francis of Assisi. Father Joe Rozanski coordinates the activities of the Order of Friars Minor in the areas of justice, peace, and integrity of creation. He comments,
"So many people like Francis, you know, across the spectrum, whether they're Catholics or not, or Franciscans or not, there's something about Francis that draws people to him. And I think one of them was his cordiality. And in a sense, I think that's kind of like covers this idea of reverence. You know, it's that you give reverence not only to creation but to the people around you. You know, nowadays, so many people, for different reasons, I think they kind of live in their own world. And in some ways, maybe we've lost some of that habit of reverence or of cordiality. And it just seems to me that Francis, he made everybody think that he was there for them. You know, not think, he was there for them. You know, he loved people, he loved creation, and because of that, he could reverence the creation and the people around him. And so I think, yes, you know, a reverence would be a good word that we could use for the way that we might approach our work, you know, in the world, our work for justice and peace.
Assisi, you'll always be home to me. You're part of my destiny, and I'm part of you. And I'm part of you.
Human beings have an inborn longing for freedom. Today, most countries do not tolerate slavery, and the mere concept of slavery is abhorrent. Yet, there are also those countries where it is not only still common, it is, as it was in generations past, that the sweated labour of slaves is an essential part of the nation's economy. Human rights don't come into the issue. Some people enjoy the profits that others generate through a servitude they are unable to escape. So how was it that free and independent Africans ended up as slaves in America? Just keep on listening.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone words from home, alone words from.
Of course I had heard of Goree. Goree piazzas are to be found on the Dock Road, close to Liverpool's pierhead. I just didn't know that the original Goree is a small island just off the coast of Senegal, southeast of Dakar. I'd always known that Liverpool had connections with the transatlantic slave trade because, when I was a small child, my father showed me a large metal ring fixed into a wall. That, he said, was where the slaves were tied up when they were disembarked from the ships. It was only recently that I learned that the link between the rings and the slave trade is only local folklore. My father didn't know, and neither did anybody else to whom I spoke, that slaves were rarely offloaded in Liverpool. They didn't know that Goree piazzas were only built after Britain's abolition of slavery in 1807, 11 years after a High Court ruling that any slave who set his foot on English soil was automatically a free person. My generation grew up knowing of the connection between Liverpool and transatlantic slavery. It was a dark part of Liverpool's history. We were told about it. We saw pictures of the inhuman treatment of human beings who, against their will, had been dragged from their homes, families and countries, loaded into ships, who suffered appalling conditions and were forced into dreadful servitude. Transatlantic slavery is part of the sad side of the city's history, but it has also been an incentive to remember all that happened, so that, in remembering, it can never happen again. Tony Tibbles, keeper of the Merseyside Maritime Museum, comments.
It's a bit like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. You need to lay everything on the table, and then you're able to move forward. If you don't do that, and people are harbouring resentment about the past, then it prevents people talking and working together.
Yet, just as Liverpool children could be horrified to hear the details of a part of their past, so was a Pope deeply moved by the conditions he found when he visited Goree in February 1992.
Laissez-moi vous dire ma joie, mon émotion de vous rendre visite dans ce île célèbre de Goree.
Allow me to express my conflicting emotions at visiting this African shrine of black sorrow. It is the emotion that one naturally experiences in a place like this, so profoundly marked by the inconsistencies of the human heart, the scene of an eternal struggle between light and darkness, between good and evil, between grace and sin. Goree, the symbol of the coming of the gospel of freedom, is also, unfortunately, the symbol of the appalling madness of those who reduced into slavery the brothers and sisters to whom the gospel of freedom was destined.
Ne veux pas demeurer insensible à tout ce que représente Goree.
But who were these people who were taken from their homes in Africa to unforeseen hardships in America? Let them tell you for themselves.
My name is Okechukwu. I'm of the Igbo tribe. I don't know where I am. I don't know why I'm here. This isn't right. My life was good before I was brought here. I miss it so much. The fields, the trees, the sunshine, my people, the Igbo. Most of all, I miss my mother and father. I dream about my mother. She is in a long blue dress she wove herself. She is cooking with the herbs and spices our neighbors have grown. Father is outside chewing tobacco as he works at his fire. I even miss my metal work. I imagine my father showing me how to handle the brass, folding and heating it. The only metal I know now is around my wrists and ankles.
I am Oyeladun of the Yoruba people. My story is like everyone's here. I had a good life and was taken. Other people here want to die. I'm going to live. After several hard years, things were getting better for my people, the Yoruba. The cocoa and yams were flourishing, and there was plenty for us to do in the fields around our village. Shortly before I was taken, I was betrothed to a man from my village, Baba Tunde. He makes sculptures and masks and other beautiful things from wood. I was very happy to be his wife. We held a great celebration, a tambour. We rejoiced with drums and dancing, and I played my stikadao. It was wonderful, hopeful day, and I look back to that time and those people with great joy and longing.
I am Kwame. I was of the Asante people. I hope I will be Asante again, but I'm not sure that is possible. My people, the Asante, traded with the whites for longer than I can remember. We swapped our slaves for wood and metal weapons called muskets. Now I am one of those slaves. Like many others, I was a goldsmith in our town, Kumasi, making jewelry and statues and other decorations. I learned the skill from my father and he from his. We made many beautiful pieces. They made us wealthy. Our best customer was the Asante, although I did not agree with his taste.
When did the slave trade begin? And where did Liverpool figure in the story? Tony Tibbles responds.
It started in the late 15th, early 16th centuries in relatively small ways, but grew during the 17th and 18th centuries. And although it was abolished by Britain in 1807, it actually continued for about another 60 years after that, because there was a lot of trading going on by other countries, and there was also quite a lot of trading going on directly between places like Cuba and Brazil and Africa during the 19th century. And in fact, about a quarter of all Africans who were enslaved and transported across the Atlantic happened after 1807. By the end of the 18th century, Liverpool was the principal port in Europe that was involved.
The slave trade reached its height during the 18th century, a period which coincided with the Industrial Revolution in Britain. The invention of the spinning jenny and of huge looms that were eventually powered by steam rather than water created an insatiable demand for cotton goods. Their cost of manufacture plummeted, enabling people to buy these materials at an affordable price, further increasing the thirst for cotton. When, in America, the cotton gin was invented, it made possible the production of greatly increased quantities of yarn. However, cotton production itself was highly labour-intensive. The best way of ensuring a large labour force without too much expense was to utilise the work of slaves. So how were the slaves brought from Africa? Again, let them tell you their own stories.
Everything is so clear in my head, yet so confusing. There was shouting and firelight in the darkness, then the smell of burning and my people screaming. Outside our home I saw our enemies. They had flaming torches and were shouting. There were so many of them. The smoke, the fire and the noise, I was confused. I felt a blow to my head, then hands grabbing me. My mother screamed, then fell silent with the explosion that seemed to come from one of our enemies. Then I went to sleep. I wish I had stayed asleep. When I woke, I was far from my home. I was very scared. I thought that I was to be a slave of our enemies. There were other men from my village with me, but their looks told me that things were very bad for us. They were right. I don't know how far we walked, but it was a long way. My head hurt and I felt so sick.
We had heard about the white people with their money and their guns from the people we traded with. I had even seen some of their strange pots and metal and beads from faraway place. We had heard that the white people bought our slaves and even took other people. Why would they want so many people, and where could they be taking them? We had feared the white people, but it was people we called neighbors that we should have feared. Two men came one day while I was looking after the village children. They seemed to want to trade. Too late, I realized that there were many more hiding outside, some holding what I later learned were guns. I kicked and punched and screamed for the others in the field, but my friends and family were too far away to help us. They expected me to just walk away from my village. Would they let a stranger take them away so easily? I refused, so instead they first carried, then dragged me until my feet and knees bled. A day's journey took us to the coast and the ocean.
I don't know why the Asantehe lied. He said I cheated him, that I sold him poor quality gold. Other young men, some I know well, were accused of crimes as well. I think he planned to sell us to the white slave traders. Some of our others tried to struggle against the guns and chains. There was no point. I saved my strength. I don't see my family. I fear for my wife, Kesi, and our son, Adisa. I hope my father is there to care for them. I hope they are safe. I think the Asantehe will tell my father lies and try to cheat him again. I try to be angry, hoping it will stop me falling into misery like the others here, but it is difficult. The traders were calm when they took us. They have had practice, and I know what they are doing. We were chained, each to the other by hands and feet, and made to walk the long road. I knew where we were going, a 9-day walk to the coast, where we would be sold to the white men. This was the time to escape, but there was no chance. On the first day, my partner in chains fell to the floor, twisting and foaming at his mouth. The traders saw his weakness and kicked and whipped him all the way to the coast. Any chance for me to run disappeared then. If I had worked in the gold mine or even in the fields, I might have walked easier. The heat, weight of the metal, insects, and distance hurt so much. I was almost happy when we felt the sea breeze and saw the blue of the water. The white of the sails on the white man's ship was less comforting.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, alone words from home.
And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I am Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.